Hello, and welcome to the 207th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Thursday, the 4th of July, 2023, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week, we welcome Thomas Harden to the show to talk about his thoughts on socialist planning. He recently published a post called Co-Simulation and Feed-Forward Planning that you can find on his blog, Thomas's Place in Cyberspace. This week, I have the new patrons Leah Naama Ten Brink, Emra, Fia, and Evan to thank. Work on the book is progressing apace, and if you'd like to find out more about the book that Donal and myself are writing, and how you can help support us in the project, please head on over to theclasslesssocietyinmotion.com. Okay, to the discussion. Thomas, welcome to the show. You sent me an email there a few weeks ago, telling me that you had recently been doing a bit of research into the Soviet planning system. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you've learned over the last few months?
Yeah, so basically, I see a lot of people who they seem to be arguing against fiction. So I like to call this Uncle Joe sits in his office and decides things about the entire Soviet economy, which isn't how it worked at all. You can also call it like straw planning, perhaps. It has more akin to a distributed control system when you start looking at it, because you have like different departments that coordinate things between each other. It's not strictly hierarchical. You have your multiple ministries that both talk to Gosplan, they talk to the workplaces, but they also talk to the other ministries. So there is, I've seen the word heterarchy used to describe this system. So for example, a big issue they had is that Gosplan couldn't plan for everything. They didn't have the data. And all they're getting is aggregate statistics, for example, that they kind of have to do an approximate thing with. Yeah, I'd say it's very interesting to see how it worked, and even more interesting how it didn't work. Like, both in cases, like failures in the system, but also just pure, like, it seems a lot of people just imagine that the Soviet economy worked in various ways, which it didn't.
Right, so we've been reading, just recently finished a chapter for the book we're writing on central planning, and we've been doing similar work to yourself. And, when you get into it, you see that it's actually a mix of centralized, decentralized, and every layer in between. Like, the idea that everything was centralized is greatly exaggerated. One of the stats that we have that we came across in one of these papers was that by like the mid 1970s, there was only around just shy of about 2000 products that were centrally planned. Everything else was decentrally planned at the republic or the local levels, which is very different than what even the kind of literature between the Austrians and arguing with the socialists about how the planning went, as in it doesn't seem to correspond to the reality of the social planning system.
Yeah, one thing I like saying, or I've been thinking about saying, it's a little bit provocative, but the Soviet economy was neither planned, neither centralized nor planned. So because, you have different departments doing their own thing, coordinating amongst each other. And there is a paper called The Soviet Union Has an Administered, Not a Planned Economy by John Howard Wilhelm, which kind of makes the same point that it's a lot of ex post control as opposed to ex ante, which is a point that Nick Rogers made as well on the previous guest. So, it's when you start reading about it, and people have been trying to model it as well. I found a paper by Michael Manov called A Model of Soviet-Type Economic Planning, which tries to mathematically model how the Soviet economy worked. It's still like approximate, like it's never, but they show that it actually does converge eventually on a solution. But it's just, it takes a couple of iterations and the system is so slow, it takes months and months of back and forth, which is kind of why we want to automate this, or at least I would like to automate it. Basically because we see what happens if you don't. You can only manage a couple of thousand goods and that's it.
Yeah, like the Soviet economies, they replace like the kind of quick market feedback function with a slow planning feedback function. You know, in effect, it added a fetter to the mode of production that isn't there in capitalism.
Yeah, I wrote about this recently, actually. It occurred to me, and this connects to the good regulator theorem, that the Soviet economy did work, like, for 70 years. It obviously worked, like, they it didn't collapse immediately, let's say, or was dismantled. But I suspect the reason that it could function despite the slowness is because they use feed-forward planning. So the entire point of having, for example, technical coefficients that describes how a workplace functions is so that you can kind of, you can anticipate what all the, both the upstream and the downstream workplaces need. And then you have kind of a slop left that you have to deal with. And often there's where you get the gray market and stuff to kind of paper over some of the, you know, you might get a 95% solution doing it by hand. And with this slow approach, but it's, you know, it kind of works. So it's very fascinating.
So when you say a feed forward function, what do you mean?
So basically there are two ways of affecting control. There's feedback and there's feed forward. And feedback is when you control a valve, for example, based on an error signal. So, or for example, you want to control the temperature of a room, and you control your heater. Well, you could either have a thermometer in the room that you read off, and then as the temperature shifts from your desired set point, you increase the power of your heater, and then, you know, a typical PID control. But what's better is that you measure the temperature outside the room in advance, because you know that if the temperature differs outside, you know that the temperature inside the room will match it in time. So you can control the heater in anticipation of the room's temperature changing. Perhaps a simpler explanation, a simpler comparison is, you know, when you get goosebumps on your arm, that's a form of feed-forward control. So the body wants to maintain a certain temperature, and there is a system where if your core temperature goes down, it'll increase, you know, it'll spend energy to get it warmer again. But if you get cold wind over your hand or over your arm, then the body thinks that, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to get cold. So I better raise the hairs on my arm here to counteract this. And that's a much faster thing. So it's kind of in anticipation. So
this gets to the same, like the point that Nick Rogers was making last episode, which is completely correct, that like any functioning economy has both ex post and ex ante elements.
Yes.
That there's no pure ex ante or ex post. Capitalism plans and reacts, and a socialist society would need to plan and react also.
Correct. You could say, and there is a bit of a language problem here, so you could say that we have planned planning and unplanned planning. So a little bit of a wordplay there.
So explain what you mean by what you're trying to get at there, by what you mean as planning.
Well, so planning, when we say planning, what we really mean, and I'm going to borrow here a term from Meretz and Sutterlitti, they use the term mediation in kind, as opposed to mediation by value. And this is what planning is. And then we have various ways of, you know, doing this mediation, you know, making sure we get all the use values we want where we need them. And you can either do this, you know, trying to anticipate what's going to be necessary. And that is ex ante, and it's quite kind of formally equivalent to feed forward. But you will always have a kind of an error, and that's where your ex post regulation comes in. So you still need ex post, and it is fundamentally ex post anyway, because if you're modeling a workplace, say, that's making, I don't know, socks or shoes or whatever, and you might not know in advance how much is necessary, I don't know, how many inputs are necessary. But over time, you will build up statistics that will tell you, like, okay, usually we need this much. And that is a kind of an ex post modeling that can be used for ex ante production, or, you know, ordering things in advance. So you get the stuff precisely when you need it, maybe with a bit of margin, you know, 10% extra. A planner's a dozen, let's say.
Right. So we have, you know, we have this kind of idea, particularly from modern pulp production, that, well, it's not just from that, but it emphasizes it, that like the structure of the productive economy is a function of the consumption of the economy. And that plays out through what you're pointing out there, that it is the consumption that determines what our actual ex ante planning will do, because we're using the historical data to build up our visions of what is required for planning going forward.
Yes. And even in cases where you have, so there are cases where you don't have this data and you might not be able to get it. But if you take something that I'm familiar with, which is building electronics, then every electronic thing, like if you look at your mobile phone, that has a bill of materials. So you know exactly what is necessary to make a phone. But that's not the entire story still, because first of all, it takes a certain amount of labor to put it together. And you have a yield. So you're not going to get 100% yield when you're making anything. So you might get 99%. So you have to take that into account as well. So, which is something you do when you order parts for an electronics project. You order a little bit extra because, you know, the yield will not be 100%. But if you're making a lot of something and you don't want to waste resources, preferably, then you'd like to order as close to precisely as many parts are necessary. Although, you know, it's never, you know, you don't actually know, but yeah, it's a difficult problem.
Now, you were saying to me that you think that the Soviet planning system was cybernetically valid. Do you want to get into your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so the Soviet system was a viable system, and it follows the Beerian VSM when you look at it. It has all of its features, and you can even, like, you can use control theory to understand why it worked poorly, let's say. But I would still say it was a viable system, obviously, because it reproduced itself. And you have all of this kind of separation of concerns and the attenuation up the chain of command, so to speak, even though, you know, it's not strictly hierarchical, but yeah, still. So, and I know that's a controversial opinion, but yeah.
Yeah, so we you know, in our analysis now, we make out a strong case in the book for how it's actually not cybernetically viable. But what I would say is that the Soviets and the planners and the bureaucracy, it's not as non-viable as I think a lot of people make out it to have been. That they were extremely practical people, and that, what would you say, the ideological element of the party or the society would have said planning, we do planning in advance and conscious planning, but in reality, it was highly reactive and it was trying simply to try and get things to work. So I disagree with you that it was cybernetically valid, but there was definitely an attempt by them to get the thing to work, right? I would say as well that, like, the existence of a system for a long period of time doesn't necessarily mean that it was cybernetically valid. Like, you know, Beer in his analysis will take examples of companies where basically the system 4 function was missing and they plod along for ages. And then they eventually fall over because they don't have long-term viability built in. And I think there's definitely elements of that. I think there's elements missing in the local management function as well, with the lack of a hard budget constraint. So I think there's quite a few elements that was probably quite lacking, but not to say that it's non-functional as stereotypically was made out.
Yeah, no, and I think you can quantify, like, some of these problems. When you look at the good regulator theorem lays down some of the concepts here. So like the perfect regulator would consist of like a perfect model and like perfect actuators, zero delay, like a short a planning period as possible, and an infinite plan horizon. That would be kind of your perfect thing.
So you said serial delay. What do you mean there?
The delay between, you know, an error occurring or whatever, and the system correcting for it. You want this to be as short as possible. So what's called that's really the plan period. And ideally, you know, we'd like a plan period of 1 second or something. But maybe that's not practical for workplaces to have orders change every second. But yeah, I agree. Like, this is kind of a purposeful position to generate discussion.
Well, I suppose it gets down to, because I think we have, like, myself and Donal and yourself, we kind of have a fundamental disagreement about what is the nature of planning, like what planning means. Do you want to, like, because we have it as a, it's much more like the, we would see that a socialist planning would model in large senses capitalist planning as opposed to something radically different. But the planning is based upon communist social relations, where I think you have a conception that is still wedded to a type of, forgive me if I'm misrepresenting it now, but some kind of centralized control of planning, in the sense that a solver that gets a whole load of information and finds out centrally what is an optimal solution for the economy.
Yeah, well, first of all, yes, you have to have full centralization. That is a necessary thing for good regulation. It is very difficult to make a good regulator without full logical centralization. You want all the data. There is a second issue where, so suppose you want to make, you want a viable plan, let's say, that stretches hundreds of years into the future. Because you can't have like a, you have to look further than the next plan period. You can't like just look 1 year ahead. You have to look, it's in control theory, this is known as receding horizon planning, which Dave Zachariah has been working on with Luca Hagberg. And then, you know, you get the question like, okay, well, how do you ensure that you have feasibility in your system? Like, you will have millions of constraints that you have to satisfy. And you can't do this by hand or by discussing with people. You have to have a computer have at it. But of course, you know, you position your political structure around it. But if you start trying to split it up and you put people in between to mediate the planning process, then you will reinstantiate the problems of the Soviet system. Because part of the issue is that you have people in there that have low bandwidth, they are self-interested, and like they lie. This very recurring theme is that they this kind of planning poker, which we would like to get away from. But there is also the question of like, what does the word central mean? Like, if we talk about central planning, what exactly is it that we're centralizing? Because you can have all the data in one place. And I would argue you have to have all the data in one place. It has to be accessible as a single state, which I believe you and Donald are saying as well with the general ledger. Yeah, that's centralized.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's a centralization of data, but it's a difference from centralization of control. Like, if you look at the viable system model, the whole thing is about variety, you know, management, having requisite variety at the different levels. And so, like, it is not the case that the system, say, 5, has full centralization of control of what everything is done. That the very epitome of a viable self-organized system is that it attenuates variety up the chain massively to allow the central nodes to be able to plan, okay, and maintain the coherence of the organism as a whole. So, like, it's fundamentally not the case that, like, the, you know, the CEO sitting in the office, like Beer would say, he should have access to every single piece of point of information in the firm. that the System 5 actually just gives more directional and policy type issuance, you know, whereas they're not making decisions about what type of plastic should we apply to this or what type of rubber band should be used on this part of a pulley on a machine.
Yeah, no, but some of those are technical decisions that are, you know, you can leave it up to workers to figure out, or you can automatically choose between different production methods.
But you see, but that's not full centralization. That's decentralized control.
No.
Applicable.
Okay, so it depends on what you mean. Like, again, it's like words are very important. So what me and Dave are trying to get at is that it's basically what Max Grünberg talks about, like automating away the center. You want to push it down to the workplaces, and the stuff you have on top. So you might have deciding bodies around the planning system that, for example, let's take environmental constraints. Someone has to decide what the atmospheric composition is going to be. And once decided, you encode it. And that's that. You put it into the system. It's there as an in-kind constraint. You are not allowed to violate it. And if you do, there will probably be repercussions. But you might also talk about like who can act in the system. And that's, of course, like that's an entire, you know, that's politics eventually. But we cannot have it to where workplaces can basically emit however much they want. And it's very difficult. Like, I haven't seen any proposal like how would you deal with, let's say, emissions without having a global view. There's like very strong theory suggesting that like you have to kind of.
Yeah, well, I have no disagreements that you have to have global view on certain elements. So like the point like that we would say is that things that need to be decided globally shouldn't be decided globally. Things that need to be decided, you know, at different layers of recursion should be decided at different layers of recursion. You know, this is all, cybernetically kind of basic stuff. But when we get towards full centralization, like that was the thing you said, we need full centralization. That would say to me, you know, that everything needs to be centralized. And that would seem to be kind of not cybernetically valid, if I'm understanding you correctly.
Well, it depends on what you centralize. It depends on what you mean. So we're making...
But like the word full, like if... So for example, me and Donal would, and our analysis would say, you know, absolutely, certain things need to be centralized, right? And other things don't need to be centralized, right? What is the amount of theaters in a district is certainly not something for like the world planning body to care about. But what is the level of, oil use or natural gas use or lithium mining or something might actually be something that is global in effect.
Yeah.
And should be centralized.
Yeah, well, it then they're talking about decision power, right? And you're not talking about the planning system as such, I would argue. So what we want is that people struggle over the same system. So everyone connects to the same database or whatever, and you can get all, you know, you can get all your accounting, for example, all your you can have a general catalog, for example. I don't know if you mentioned that. That's one thing I would want to have, because it's incredibly irritating that you have different, like, I can't just order a thing, like, I don't know, copper pipes. I have to go to each and every damn distributor and see if they have it. It's annoying. It works differently. But to some extent, I suspect there is a bit of a language issue, and maybe full centralization doesn't quite describe what I'm getting at. It's kind of, that's the problem with language. So,
well, let's talk about it from the point of view of maybe the solver. Okay, because I think this is something that's integral to your work, so that there is the data is somehow centralized, and then there is a decision made centrally about how to optimize production, Would that be a fair representation?
Well, you don't need to optimize production. That's something I've recently come to realize. So, I mean, disagree.
Okay, optimize in, right, optimize in some fashion, as in optimize for viability as opposed to maybe optimize for output or whatever.
Well,
but there are some criteria which you're solving centrally.
Well, suppose you have a certain, you're at a certain operating point. You'd like to be able to tell each workplace, you can operate within these bounds, for example. Something I've been looking at recently, I forget what I called the post, but yeah, it's a quantifying autonomy and planning. My point here is to trying, when you start having bounds in your system, you cannot have like, I don't know, workplaces burning barrels of oil for no reason. There is a question of like, how much wiggle room does each workplace have? I cannot think of any way to deal with this without computation, and then you can then like tell every workplace like, okay, you can move within this without having to talk to anyone. You can make, you know, you can plan your own production locally, as long as you're within this rectangle or whatever. But as soon as you start stepping outside, then you need to coordinate with other workplaces, and it starts slowing down the thing. You start getting into like worse, but you don't necessarily need to have a solver. I think what I would say is you need some mechanism by which in-kind constraints are respected.
Yeah, no, we fully agree with that, and we think that what you're talking really about is a system of algodonics. So for people who aren't up on the cybernetic lingo, this is like Beer's idea between, say, different elements in the control system of like the VSM, between your local management, your the coalface element, your system one, and your planning, and your basically your boardroom, your executive decision making of an organization, of a particular recursion, that there are pain signals that can go through. For example, the example you're saying is that some workplace is using way too much oil, and that will trigger a warning. And that will need to be essentially resolved at either within that VSM itself, or perhaps even externally. It pings up towards the great chain of being. Yeah, we fundamentally think that is the correct approach. But I don't understand when you say computation to do with that. So I think we're kind of getting towards, I don't know if we are have quite, we're moving to towards a similar ground. But it's like that when you say computation in this sense, do you mean like a system of thresholds that trigger behaviors, or, you know, as opposed to a global solver?
Well, it depends on what you want to do. So you could, for example, optimize locally if you want. In a certain region, you might say we want to maximize the number of slides or whatever, you know, the number of playgrounds here. We want to build, or we want to move from having no playground to having 10 playgrounds or whatever. That's something that's called goal programming. But you want to make sure you can do this without stepping on anyone else's toes. And that requires computation. So, but if we take a counterexample, like the kind of thing that I would say we don't need to do any.
When you say computation, sorry, I you say computation, and I'm not certain what you mean. So when you say computation, like what do you mean when you say computation there? Say that example of a district wants to have more slides, more playgrounds, say.
Well, let's say you want to figure out what level of autonomy you have. Like what kind of decisions can I make locally without interfering with anyone else? And in this post, I demonstrate how you can do this. You can give each workplace an interval, basically, saying like, okay, you can operate within these intervals, no problem. And doing that requires computation. Like you have to compute, you have to fit a box inside your plan polytope, like, or your constraint polytope. So you, given like environmental constraints of the number of labor hours available, on, you know, what people need, food, etc. Like there are clearly certain operating points which are unacceptable. Like you can't allow the oil refinery to stop because you need fuel. So they cannot decide to stop, like, because then people will die. And of course, you need to figure out then a political system on top of this. Like, so that's, and we don't say much about that other than saying like, okay, there will be some political system. There will be a way, like people will need to decide the boundaries. But I would argue you could allow a lot of autonomy within said boundaries. And I don't think you need to, at least what me and Dave are saying, if you're going to optimize on something or minimize something, minimize labor in that case, we would be very much opposed to what Cockshott and his student Philip Daprisch, who are still going on about this, you know, maximizing GDP, which I think is very silly. I don't think we should do that. Because then you get the question, okay, you have an objective function that you're maximizing, let's say. Well, who decides the objective function?
Right, yeah. So the society should determine for itself what it optimizes in any kind of unalienated society. So like, I would say that when computation is used typically in the type of conversations that we have, and I think some of the discussions we've had before, it's definitely more at the level of a centralized solver. Like, for example, the type of things that you're talking about, from our point of view, as all information is sitting and it's sitting on the general ledger. For a particular, let's take an example of the oil refinery, that the lads in the oil refinery say, "Ah, lad, let's just go on the booze. Let's not bother working today," right? Mm. That the actual flows of goods and materials, the transactions get picked up on the general ledger immediately as being missing. You know, there is no deliveries today when there should be 25,000 barrels of oil delivered or whatever. And that sitting on top of the general ledger is a whole system of like what is essentially that allows planning to occur with like algodonics and building in a sitting on top of it as basically a kind of a platform. Things that lay out what are the social relations of production and the management and the control system upon that. And so, like, to the extent that that is computation, well, we're full on for our computation, right?
Yeah.
To the extent that there is solving, like, as in technical solving, like, if we look at capitalism does use input-output sometimes stuff to do things. Not a lot, but it does use it. And to the extent that where optimization can be done within the production system, or even within, say, trying to understand planning at a larger scales, to the extent that they help, you know, we're like completely agnostic as to what tools are used. But the idea that the planning is centralized, that information is sent to the center, and the plan is centralized, we think that that is, we'll argue, you know, strongly against that for cybernetic reasons, but also if we look to how pull production, if we were to look at, say, the centralized ideas of production in the Soviet Union of central planning, that's much more closely aligned to kind of like a Fordist maximization of mass production based management system, as opposed to, say, like a Toyota production system where things are pull production and they are self-organized. And so to the extent that, like, Marx critiqued Proudhon for wanting to go back to artisanal production as the basis for socialism, we will argue against a return to a centralized, if we want to call it the solver, centralization of data. But not to say that data, you can't use techniques, or that data is not open to everybody and thus centralized, if you get the distinction.
No, I think what some people are afraid of is, so me and Dave use the term data asymmetry to describe like one of the problems of the Soviet Union. It's like people have privileged access to data, which is bad. Like we want it to be completely open. It would be beneficial to know what the other guys are doing, like the other workplaces, and what they're planning on doing. So they might. So if we have a system of constraints, let's say, it can suggest a set of plans, but these suggestions have to be concretized, and it may be tricky to fully explain. But say you are to produce, I don't know, you need to produce propane and petrol, basically, And let's pretty, like, you might have different plans that are slightly better at one or the other. They could jointly agree to take on certain parts of production and then sort of post that to the ledger or whatever you call it, the order system. So you've committed to doing this specific thing, but then you have the planning system. There will still be like a residue of stuff that needs to be done, but then you can, as soon as you post your concrete order, you know, what you're taking on, the system can replan and resuggest new things to other workplaces automatically. So you remove degrees of freedom from the system, yeah, because people have taken on work. But yeah, you don't necessarily need to have it to where, you know, you're computing a single point that everyone has to operate on, or else. You can have it to be a little bit more, you can have a lot more leeway, a lot more, you know, local autonomy, but it has to still be within bounds. So you have to figure out what the bounds are. Like, you have to, you'd like to orthogonalize the different parts of the system. And that is a very tricky thing.
When you say orthogonalize, you know, I don't know, it's a mathematical term, so people might know what you mean. In this context, what do you mean? You want to have different elements that are essentially, you can cleave off and be separate and solve separately, I assume.
Yeah. It would be asking the question, like, to what extent can people operate completely independently? And figuring that out is difficult even on a computer. So, and the nice thing about it is you can do whatever you want. You can sort out all the details about oil production or whatever, so long as kind of the cleaving plane, as long as you kind of, yeah, it's difficult to explain, let's say. But I would say I don't think we have to go for this, like, okay, you compute a single plan and that's it. I think you can have a little bit more uncertainty, let's say.
I would say from our point of view, planning is a management of constraints, essentially. It's, are we constrained by the amount of teak we can cut down, the amount of oil we can produce, the amount of land use we want to have, the amount of time people want to work, that it's the amount of labor that needs to be involved in producing a certain output, that all these are constraints, and that we have this incredibly complex, n-dimensional blob,
yeah,
that is trying to maintain its presence in a certain position of viability, you know, a sphere of, what do they call it? I can't remember the technical term. And it is not true like a centralization of every point of production, but it's really, it's self-organization where valid, and also changing in grand scale policy where required to maintain this n-dimensional economic blob in a particular area of viability.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what capitalism essentially does, although it's based on a class system. It's centralized where it needs to be centralized. You know, it's got the state and it's got central banks, and it also has corner shops, and it's got a chipper down the road, right? And in between, it'll have a business organization as well. We're like, so we kind of are modeling, not to say that capitalism is long-term viable, no more than the Soviet Union is, right? But that it's in a kind of a temporary area of a viability space. But what we see as the kind of mode to try and get to, or to get to the type of ability to make those decisions that you're making is the concept of recursion. So the nested layers of viable systems. So for example, if we were to talk about, like, perhaps, what was the example, refineries or something, oil refineries, that we might have at the higher level of recursion, we might have an oil refineries association of producers, and that will be able to regulate the lower levels, and it must be self-interested in regulating the lower levels. And also that at a higher level of recursion, there might be an energy one, and the energy one might be motivated to say to the wind farms, hey guys, you got to do this, and to the oil producers, you got to do this, and that the whole thing has to be cybernetically valid but also social relationally valid, that people are self-interested in the control system, in being the control system.
Yeah,
I think we seem to be finding common ground in some of this, I think.
Yeah, but I like some. Of course, like you can. There are limits to how much you can steer from these higher, like the energy department or whatever. But they might put in like, okay, we need these many. No, they might not even, because so for example, the need for electricity comes from the demand for stuff that needs electricity. So that's not really something that they can decide. That's more a...
Well, it's this ex post, ex ante, isn't it? Feed forward, feedback madness.
Yeah. It's dialectical, you see. But if we could take one example where you might need to go with this kind of more Soviet style, rather aggressive, and that is, you know, global warming. So that will require an immense shift. And Dave has been making the point, and Dave Zachariah, if the listeners don't know, Dave has made the point, or I think we both made the point at the Marx 22 conference in Stockholm, that the amount of coordination and the amount of resources necessary to deal with the climate crisis is greater than the Second World War. Like the sophistication in like organization and everything is so much bigger. To some extent, you kind of have to you can do it with constraints. So you can have an emissions constraint that you constantly push down. And in fact, that's how a certain class of LP solvers work, so-called central path methods. So you can have an emissions constraint that you're moving slowly over time, so people have time to adapt and so on. So there is kind of, you can try to do kind of a crash decarbonization, but there are, like if you try to optimize on emissions, so you have your objective function and you're pushing it really hard in a certain direction, you will reach like a corner in the system. Like you will hit up against a whole bunch of constraints. And if there's any kind of error in those constraints, then you can easily get into like outside of feasibility. So there is like a case to be made that like you can't be too, I don't know, too male about it, let's say. Because, you know, it's a vector and it points in, you know, rather than, you know, your constraint box in your economy. Yeah, I think we're sort of in agreement, but there isn't language for this stuff. It's very difficult to get at what, because I like to think like, how would I use a system like this? How would I, like, I have some petty means of production. Like, how could I make them available to a prototype system, let's say? Because I know stuff and I have tools.
Well, you see here, Thomas, you see, you would be part of the planners associated producers, and then you'd be able to share your knowledge and standardize our work through that, you know, because I think it's interesting looking at the Toyota production system, because they rely on essentially these kind of pseudo communist relations where everybody gets the same wage on the production lines and they're all motivated to improve and solve at the point of production the actual workers. But also then what's heavy about it is in Toyota is that they standardize. Once they solve a thing, they standardize it. And that's essentially what we're trying to get to in the solver. But they do it just through pure social relations. So for us, it would be like, if you got good ideas on your how the hell do we do this climate change stuff, that it would be through the social relations of the structure of the, you know, productive system, as in you would be, say, OK, I want to work in the climate stuff, and ideas would percolate and standardize, and ideas would modify and progress in that manner. It's not just general ledger, like, you know, this stuff was on the it's not like just a technical system. It's a social relational system, you know?
Yeah, of course. There's more. Yes, of course. But, you know, I'm an engineer, so I focus on practical problems. Oh, I mentioned one thing that we could plug, because I realize you're because I haven't heard you do it on the podcast, is the InDep network.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, has it launched yet?
It's launching on the 13th of July. And he'll be sending out, Eric Meyer will be sending out an invite. There's two events, one for Europe, Africa, the Middle East, kind of that part of the globe, and then for the Americas. And he would have liked to have like Asia and that part of the world, but there's not enough contacts. So maybe we should encourage the listeners to point their web browser to indep.network.
Absolutely. Yeah, myself and Donal and Ferdia, who people may know, are kind of involved in that. Mostly Ferdia doing all the groundwork, it must be said. And it's trying to get like a kind of an international planning network discussion area open to all, what would we say, tendencies, as a kind of a way to move the whole area forward. It's looking like it should be very interesting. It's supposed to launch soon. I missed the last couple of meetings due to work commitments, but hopefully it'll be a really good venue for people who are interested in these planning topics to maybe participate or go to read some stuff that gets put on the website or events that get put on. So yeah, it's really interesting to see, though. There's a lot of interest in the general planning, socialist planning stuff. We just organized, myself, Donal, and Ferdia have put in a proposal for 5 panels at the Historical Materialism Conference in London this year. Like a couple of years ago, there would be zero. There would be nobody. They have a whole stream this year. Usually in these conferences, not that I know too much about them, but they'll have like, you know, areas of focus. And this year, post-capitalism, so like the kind of planning stuff was one, which was, it's good to see that there's movement and work being done by people in Sweden and Dublin and all over the place.
Yeah. And it's also, it's like really important when you, because if you look at like the climate debate, you either have like green capitalism or degrowth, and none of them are viable, really. You have to kind of deal with this in an orderly fashion. You can't just blow up pipelines. Those are our pipelines you're talking about, or that Andreas Malm is talking about.
Unless, of course, they're in the Baltic Sea, and then you're well able to blow up whatever you want.
No, they never blew. We're shutting down the investigation. Yeah. No one is at fault.
Yeah.
It's a mystery.
What pipeline? Move along.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw Donald actually on, what was it, Marxism Today.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know.
Didn't you see that? They talked about the movie How to Blow Up a Pipeline. And I learned that Donald has a
pedigree.
A record.
He has a pedigree, yes. He would be the expert in such matters. Let's just put it like that. Leave it like that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that was really interesting. But yeah, that's a thing that me and Dave are trying to get at with the environmental thing. Like, we're going to need to use refineries and pipelines. But like, we have to feed them, like, I don't know, scrap wood or whatever from gasification. Like, you can turn bio waste and you can do like BECCS, right? Bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. So one example would be you take trees or you take wood waste. So you take that to a gasification plant, you dry distill it, and you get syngas out of it. And for listeners who may not be aware, syngas is a mixture of hydrogen and carbon monoxide. This you can turn into oil using what's known as the Fischer-Tropsch process. The Germans did this during the Second World War.
With coal. They used coal, didn't they?
Yeah. But you get coal as a byproduct. You get charcoal, biochar. And you can bury that. You can use it as fertilizer even. You add the...
It's very effective fertilizer. It's really, really good. Yeah.
So you're... And it's very clear, like, you're putting... Physically putting coal in the ground, back in the ground, like it's very easy to understand. And you get fuel out of it. But of course, this entire process has to be, you have to think about it globally. Like you have to plan forest production, for example. Forestry is one example that me and Dave want to use. Because forestry happens on a 100-year horizon. So you have to do this kind of receding horizon planning that we're talking about. You at least need to have like sanity checks on what you're doing. So you ensure that there's sufficient fuel for the stuff that needs it. You're putting carbon in the ground. maybe you can figure out that, well, if we do more public transit, you know, the demand for fuel decreases, there's more space to maneuver in the big old planning polytope, the big blob. There's a lot you can do, and it may be the case that we need to invest in, I don't know, refineries, for example. There's nothing like this in the degrowth, or very little like this in the degrowth sphere, as far as we can tell.
Yeah, like I'm absolutely extraordinarily far from being up to date on any of these things, but it would strike me as, if we were really serious about dealing with decarbonization, that you would bootstrap on the existing carbon infrastructure to get a decarbonized infrastructure. Right, that the solution is not...
There's a lot you can do.
The solution is not to blow up the pipe now, but to use that pipe now to decarbonize in 5 years' time or whatever. That's the general... I assume that's the most logical approach.
Well, you take whatever you have on hand, and then that's why we need planning, because you kind of have to figure out how to fit all of this together. And no human can do this, really. You need sanity checks at the very least. Like, you need constraints.
You know, absolutely. Like, I would see, like, you know, to the extent that you would want to plan a decarbonization thing, it would require probably models of the scale of the IPCC type reports to actually try and do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they would exist for us within a framework then that is self-organized and as guides towards production. You know, our sanity checks, as you call it. So, like, These type of planning will work. We've done the kind of general high level look at how these interactions work. Yeah, this looks pretty good. Okay, yeah, as a society, we think that's a pretty good way we should go. And right, let's try and implement it and use that to help and inform our progress, et cetera, and feedback into it.
Yeah. For me, anyway, it's easier to think in terms of constraints. So you're kind of, you're pushing them a little bit and then the system moves a little bit and you push them a little bit more. And that's fine. Actually, we could go back a little bit to how the Soviet system worked, because in there you have, which I recently learned, you had something called the optimizing school, which were like people talking about this kind of, you know, you wanna optimize production. They were looking at ways to. You have this thing called kosrachet, right? It's this way of costing thing. Basically, they were trying to put a price on certain things. This is basically the entire liberalization of the Soviet economy starts with these optimizing planners, sort of, amusingly enough. So one of these guys, and I forget the name, one of these quirks of history, I forget what the name of the paper is, but I think Dave sent me a really good paper on the history of this. Like, what led up to the liberalization, and it turns out it's kind of comes out of the planning debate. And there's also, I don't know if you've heard of the Kosov interviews. So Alexei Safronov he's of the Prime Numbers channel on YouTube. It's like you know, Russian guys making videos on communist topics. He did an interview with a guy who was one of the heads of Gosplan called Vladimir Kosov. And this guy is still alive. He's in like his 90s. And it's really, really interesting. I don't know if he's published them anywhere. He sent me a link over email. I could share it with you. But it gives an insight into how Gosplan actually worked. And it's really, really interesting. Like the kind of problems they had getting accurate data and you know, they talk about stuff like they get a lot of bad input from people typing in, you know, over terminal, so they had to put in what they call gates to like sanity check the reports coming in. They weren't, at least the higher ups at Gosplan were, like, ideologically committed, like they wanted things to work. But there was also like really concrete problems, like they couldn't get data fast enough. It was inaccurate. So there's a lot of stuff like that.
Well, Thomas, thanks for coming on the show today. Do you want to plug your website or anything else that you've been working on recently?
Yeah, I mean, the listeners can check out my website. And I have, you know, I write about planning and I have a YouTube channel as well. I may be putting up more videos there. We'll see. I will also take the opportunity to plug the INDEP network, International Network for Democratic Economic Planning. So yeah, check out the INDEP.network website.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming on the show today, Thomas.
Happy to see we agree on a lot of things, and I think we can continue to have discussions and we'll probably reach some kind of consensus eventually.
If you'd like to help fund the book that Donald and myself are writing about communist economic planning, please head over to the website, theclasslesssocietyinmotion.com, where you can donate to our fund to help us get this book out in a finite time. And if you'd like to help out the show, please remember to head over to Patreon and throw me a few commie dollar.